Hello, and welcome to the Inside EVs podcast for October the 7th, 2022. This is episode number 131. On today's show, we'll be talking about doing the Lucid Air Grand Touring 70-mile-an-hour highway range test, the reveal of the Honda Prologue, and the debut of the Maserati Gran Turismo Folgore EV. I'm Don Macchione, Inside EV's forum moderator and Inside EV's editor. Joining us today is the self-possessed Tom Malogny, Inside EV's editor and host of the YouTube channel State of Charge. We also have the meticulously manicured Mr. Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast, which is available on all the best podcast platforms. And of course, the convivial Kyle Connor joins us from the majestic, practically palatial halls of Autospec Studios, where he produces high voltage videos for a growing number of YouTube channels. So welcome, everybody.
Hello.
All right. So let's kick this off with the news, and then we'll get to what we've been driving this week. So, So yesterday, Honda shared the design of its 2024 Prologue crossover SUV. It's a vehicle made using the Ultium ecosystem from GM and will be built at the Spring Hill, Tennessee factory, along with the Cadillac Lyriq, and at some point, the Acura ZDX, depends on where you're from, which is also an Ultium vehicle. We still have all the details on the various configurations, but it's likely to be similar to the Lyriq or possibly the Chevy Blazer EV, which shares the same wheelbase with those vehicles. Honda calls this design style neo-rugged, and we can see a bit of boring from the awesome little hatchback, the Honda E, with that black strip across the front there. So we can talk about your impressions of this design in a second, but first, Honda shared some of its rollout strategy, and while the language wasn't super clear, but it seems like it might only be made available to buyers in ZEV states who also chose to lease a CR-V hybrid for 2 years, like beginning this fall. So it's quite possibly the full sales strategy is much more open than this. I believe we've reached out for clarification. But Tom, does this seem like a continuation of the too little too late theme?
Well, it's clearly a compliance vehicle for Honda. You know, they're not really engineering this in-house. It's not their own technology. They need to get ZEVs out there, and this is what they're doing. So, hey, you know, I think, hardcore Honda fans will probably like it. It's the right size and shape. It's probably going to have pretty decent technology with Ultium technology in it. But, yeah, it's going to be as little as they have to do to get by, and it kind of shows it. You know, it's kind of a boring, plain design. Some people like that. I don't know, the whole neo-rugged. I hope they mean neo from like the 80s when everybody wore neo colors. Certainly not neo from the Matrix rugged. Right. So, but, you know, it's typical like plain Honda, not pushing the limits. And, it'll probably suit some families well. But will it be available? We don't know yet. And it doesn't look bad, but, you know, Honda – it's hard to take Honda serious until they really get serious with EVs and start doing everything in-house, design ground up, because Honda can make great vehicles, and we're sure they can make a great EV, but they just don't want it just yet.
Right. Well, they have their own E architecture coming up eventually. In a couple of years, they put the action on the press release for this. They have a little timeline of their plans, but yeah. So they do have some architecture of their own coming, but they are going to be working with GM on this vehicle and the Acura vehicle. And they also have a number of economy or more affordable vehicles coming up with GM again in 2027, which is kind of strange. But I don't know. But like this rollout thing, I don't know if you saw that. It's kind of like right at the bottom of the press release. It was this weird, strategy of rolling out, like you have to release the hybrid CR-V hybrid and then roll over your lease into the Prologue after 2 years. I don't know. It's like, it's going to be more open than that, right? That's going to be too limited. Yeah. Hopefully they'll get back to us. Because it just seems like a lot. I mean, a lot of people are online saying, that it's a compliance vehicle. It's only going to be in ZEV states, and they're only leasing it. But they've got to be selling this outright as well. It's like,
Don't say they've got to be. We've seen automakers do things like this before. ZEV state, lease only. So you would,
right.
They would, but you know, don't say it's gotta be, because we've seen other companies do that in the past.
Right. Well, so design wise, what do you think? I put out a tweet yesterday asking for opinions, and the consensus seemed to be it's appropriately boring. But I think it looks kind of sharp, except for that rear three-quarter angle. I like the back end of it a lot, but I don't know.
It doesn't look bad to me. You know, I just think it's like typical, you know, kind of not pushing the limits Honda, basic. You know, I think it'll appeal to a lot of people. I a lot of people don't want risque styling. You know, they just want something simple that blends into the pack, and this will. You know, this will drive down the road and nobody will know it's electric, and a lot of people want that in their vehicle.
Right. Kyle, any thoughts on what it looks like? Does it jump out?
Well, it's very typical Honda. I think it's, no one's going to go up to that and say, oh, it's so ugly, I'm not going to get inside. They're also not going to say, I'm so excited to get inside and drive it. So, styling wise, I think they nailed it. They just needed a car to sell very few of to reach whatever compliance they're looking for. I am a Honda guy. I like Honda products in general, more than some of their competitors in different segments. And overall, I think this is a great way to go. I mean, they chose a nice partner. It's not like they're partnering with Mazda and sharing the MX-30 architecture. They went to Ultium and, you know, they went to GM, got the Ultium system. Seems to be a pretty good system, although we haven't seen them in mass production yet. And I think it seems all good to me.
Right on. I don't know, Martin, do you have any thoughts on the styling at all?
On the styling, it's typically Honda, and it will appeal to the people that walk into the showroom, because no doubt, however you buy this car, it's going to be bought in a showroom or walking into, you know, your Honda dealer to buy it. It's really interesting to think about this next stage of the adoption curve, and we're talking about the next group of people buying electric vehicles, because, you know, you've gone from the early hardcore, you've gone from, you know, Tom doing tens of thousands of miles in his electric Mini 12 years ago, and then you've got the rest of us, slightly more sane people, that were earlier with electric vehicles, and maybe some of the people watching and listening to this have been earlier, and I think are perhaps willing to take more risks. And so, you know, you've got people who are willing to drive a car or buy a car that maybe doesn't do everything you want, or maybe isn't from a brand that you'd normally buy. But I think when you start to talk about Honda's next, you know, Honda's mainstream electric vehicle, it doesn't look any more mainstream than this. That's absolutely someone who's had a bunch of Hondas or walks into a Honda dealership and is like, right, what's the next one? Oh, it's electric. Okay. Which is fine. But how do they sell it? So if they're just doing one compliance vehicle, if it's not even really their technology, you have to think about the experience of walking into the Honda dealership. And what are the salesmen and women going to be doing? Are they going to be pointing you towards this car or one of their combustion ones? And I think that's the interesting thing about cars like this. And I don't know how many of these they sell, honestly, or how hard they even try. I was looking at the September sales figures now that we're a few days into October, and the Toyota BZ4X, zero sales last month.
Right.
Zero sales.
Well, they weren't allowed to. There was a stop sale.
Because the wheels are falling off it. So have they fixed it? Well, look.
Yes.
Look, Toyota know how to make cars, you know, and quite a few of them as well. So can they fix it? Yes. Have they? Dom says, yeah, I didn't follow it. So they're right. Not allowed. There's a stop sale on it. So that's why it's zero. But like, come on, Toyota. Come on, Honda. But
I think they can sell them now. Like Toyota has lifted the stop sale. The recall process has been done and production has resumed.
So that's back and up and running again. And it's right. Why did that take so long? Like, why are the wheels falling off that car and not anything else? So, I mean, that's just the big, as Tom says, it's the big question mark about how serious these companies about this vehicle. Looks pretty cool. I mean, it looks like a Honda and it looks like a great family wagon, but it's not so much what it looks like, how it drives the technology for me. I mean, it is good stuff underneath with the Ultium technology. It's, do they even really want to sell it? And there's a bit of you that starts to think, well, maybe not, but I hope they do.
Right. I mean, well, I guess we'll see. We'll get some more clarification on what the sales strategy is, hopefully, and we can bring that to you maybe next week. But as far as the Toyota BZ4X goes, that's one of the notes at the very bottom of the things. I was just going to mention that Toyota has resumed BZ4X production after fixing the wheel hub bolt issue. And so if you want this thing of beauty. You can go to your local Toyota dealer and ask away for one. Anyway, so what else do we have? The Maserati.
Dom, let me cut in for one sec. Sure. I was muted by mistake. So following up on the BC Force, it took 3 months for them to figure this out.
A long time.
Just out of curiosity, let's say this was a new RAV4. Like, they came out with a new RAV4, and a month or so after it was released, they realized they had this problem. How long do you think it would have taken them to fix that and get those back in showrooms being sold? You think it would have taken 3 months?
No.
So, I mean,
not at all.
Shows you how committed they are. It's like, yeah, we'll fix this. Like, put it on the board. And, when the guys in engineering have some time, they can take their vacations first. And when they have some spare time, let them figure out how to keep the wheels on the vehicle. But, we have to know that. And, it kind of seems like Honda is taking the same approach with this vehicle, kind of like, yeah, we've got to sell it. Well, maybe we'll just lease it. And maybe we'll make you lease another car first to really prove to us that you really are serious about electric vehicles. So, right. But let's hold on. Maybe that footnote that you read isn't telling the full sales strategy,
but
it was really weird that they would even mention something like that.
Yeah, there's a whole section of how they believe, SUV owners are like the natural flow of things is go from a hybrid to an electric vehicle. And I don't know, it's just not convoluted reasoning, but just like, it just looked like sort of like excuse making in a way to me, like reading it. I'm like, anyone can buy an EV. They don't have to be SUV hybrid owners. You can go from, the hybrid experience isn't that different from the regular gas experience, especially if it's not like we're not talking plug-in hybrids. We're talking just like a regular, hybrid, which you don't really interface with any of the electric parts. You feel a little bit of regen maybe, or something.
They need to ease us into it, Dom. These are different vehicles. They're weird vehicles. So you're not ready for one just to go from a gas vehicle to an EV. You've got to have this transitional period. So you're ready for it. We want your experience to be, ideal.
Right.
I don't know. It's weird.
It makes the Honda E even more intriguing to me. Like, who signed it off? Whose budget was that? Why is it so brilliant?
Right.
Who let the design
of Honda E? It's so good.
Who let the design of that through? Did nobody care? So they got it out the door because it's so brilliant. It's got whatever it is, 35 kilowatt hour pack. What, it's tiny, isn't it? Who cares?
It's 100 miles, right? It's 100 miles.
Yeah, that's not the point of it. It makes that even more intriguing to me. Like, that was such a cool car.
Yeah. I'd love to have one. I think I could make one of those work here, actually. If I can make the Spark EV here work, I can make the Honda E definitely work. And yeah.
The only problem is they're really expensive, but they're worth it because they're cool. When you see one on the road, you go, wow, that guy's got it.
Right on. So Maserati isn't a brand known for EVs, but it just debuted its second. The first was the Grecale. And, to help me if I'm pronouncing this wrong, Kyle, Grecale Folgore SUV. It's okay.
Yes, I'm sure that's not the most beautiful pronunciation of it.
I know, my Italian sucks. Oh, my God. And my name is Dominic Iani, but yeah, I don't speak Italian. And so this new one is an actual two-door GT with some pretty big numbers. Real quick, we're talking about 1,200 horsepower, 995 pound-feet of torque, from 300 kilowatt electric motors, two on the back axle, one on the front. 0 to 60 is said to be 2.7 seconds and a top speed of 198 miles an hour. The battery is 92.5 kilowatt hours with 83 kilowatt hours usable. And the battery is laid out in a T-bone shape that Maserati claims it will help. It will cover 280 miles or 450 kilometers on Europe's WLTP cycle. Deliveries begin next July, and the U.S. price is estimated to start around $170,000. Kyle, have you reserved one of these yet?
No. So the problem with Maserati is, so the cars have always been a bit crap in a charming way, older ones. And then we got into the FCA Stellantis version of Maserati, which was truly terrible. Ghibli Quattroporte shared the same start button as a Dodge Dart. The Levante is terrible in every possible way, unless you go for the Trofeo version, which is the twin turbo V8, because then it starts to get interesting. But then even just buy a Cayenne turbo. So Maserati's never had the right place. They've never caught on, and for good reason. They've kept the GT along, which is the previous version of this car, for a really long time. Six-speed torque converter automatic. 4.2 V8, was it? Something, but it sounded incredible. And that was the reason to buy that car, was the transmission was crap. The early one, the single manual, or the SMG, was terrible. Then they went to a torque converter. That was terrible. But you bought it because of the V8, and it sounded good, and it made good rev matching noises. This one, where's the charm? There's no engine. So now you're just driving a silent crap box around. I mean, we'll have to see if they improve it, if they're going to put the money in it. But again, the only reason to buy a Maserati before was A, because you couldn't afford something else that had a nice badge, or B, you wanted the noise. And like, people who drive Ghiblis or Quattroportes or something like that really miss the boat on quality and driving dynamics and everything else. So those cars are pretty dumb. This has to be a performance sports car. They've never been known for lightweight. They've never been known for great handling. And maybe if MC20 is anything to take note from, this can be really good, because they now have finally a good sports car on the market. I actually think going electric's a bit of a shame for them, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm not sure why people buy Maseratis, actually, you know, because it doesn't have the best reputation for quality or reliability.
Or I don't know performance or anything else.
Right, I don't really know. I think it's just like the badge itself is like that bling kind of crown, and also that song, "My Maserati Does 185." You know, I lost my license, but now I can't drive. And I think for a lot of like Americans, I think that's our only exposure to this brand. But you know, there's some sort of echo of romanticism, I think, calling from the 70s. You know, with this thing, so, and I see them around Tallahassee sometimes. Even there's a few around here, and I'm always kind of shake my head and kind of like wonder why, what they're thinking. But I don't know. Tom, do you have some thoughts on this?
No, you know, pretty much what Kyle said. I'm not a huge Maserati guy, and I have a couple friends that have leased them in the past, and luckily they didn't buy them. And half their lease was in the shop being fixed. I can't imagine the you know, all new powertrain, all electric, you know, going into an area that they don't have any experience with, how many issues this thing's going to have. I hope it doesn't. The specs are cool. It sounds, looks, you know, I think it looks cool. But, you know, good luck, Maserati, with that. And I think it's just, as you said, you know, romanticizing about like the name, like Maserati has some cachet. And I think people that maybe don't know a lot about cars, but want to drive something that is kind of exclusive. There's not a lot of Maseratis on the road.
Right.
And it's not, you know, there's not a lot of brands that aren't too expensive, but are exclusive. And there's a reason why there's not a lot of them, because I think the experienced automotive, like hawks, people that know cars, stay away from them. That's why there's not a lot of them out there. Hey, good luck with them. And, you know, more EVs, the better, but, you know, you wouldn't catch me leasing one of these. I would probably recommend my friends not also.
I don't
know. We don't know yet. We got to see how it handles.
Yeah.
We have to see how it performs, because if it's truly well balanced and like super fun and they get the tech right, and it's got thermal longevity, then awesome. The problem is that's a smaller battery, because yeah, people aren't going to be taking these on road trips. They don't need a huge battery. But if you're buying it because it handles well and it drives great, well, then you want to drive it fast in the mountain roads, which that's too small of a battery to do that with.
It'd be nice to have a bit more. It's like, 83 usable, 83 kilowatt hours.
I could blow through that in an hour or less in a mountain pass climb.
Yeah. I think it's too, like, way too early to write it off. I'm looking forward to first drive reviews. Like, I don't know if anyone's heard anything about first drive programs for this yet, but I wouldn't, you know. So they have not a great reputation for their, you know, internal combustion vehicles, but maybe now this is, you know, they're probably bringing in a lot of expertise from the Stellantis group. It's that, you know, it's not, I don't know.
That's the more exciting bit for me, actually, is that letting people stretch their legs at that company. Because if I think about the EVs they make, than the Peugeots, the Citroens, the Vauxhalls, the Opels, then they're pretty much got the same set of specs. It's going to be the 100 kilowatt motor, the 50 kilowatt hour battery. Like they've got the same set of tools that they've been using, and then that's getting better slightly. They've got some new generation stuff and a new factory in France to make new motors and things, but that's going to be their next gen. But I think what's interesting more about this is just letting they sell 24,000-25,000 Maseratis a year globally. So to Kyle's point of why are they electrifying the brand? Well, they would get, certainly over here in Europe, with the way that the regulations are going, they would get an exception, if you like. I forget the actual word for it. Was it a derogation or something? But they would be accepted as a niche brand, and they wouldn't fall under the 2030 or 2035 EV rules. So let them carry on making really interesting combustion stuff, because you know there's a million electric vehicles. It's a million plug-in vehicles, or is it pure EV, hitting the roads every year now, as of last month in September, right, globally. So the really big numbers are happening, and we are moving towards clean, green transport to do all those boring chores that we do in our vehicle. That's great. So if 20,000 people a year in the world want to buy something stupid in 10 years' time, I don't have any problem with that. Like, it's not going to nudge climate change. It's not going to... and all of that. So, but for Stellantis, what is interesting is, 900 volts... or 900 volt architecture, new motors, new batteries, finding out how to make a really high performance sports car like Lotus have been talking about, with that T-shaped battery. So not a skateboard design, but making sure that it goes through where the transmission tunnel would have been, under where the rear seats would be. So, get your hip line as low to the floor as possible, make a really interesting sports car that, that handles like a sports car. Like if you work at that company then, and you get the chance to work on this project, that knowledge surely filters down. So maybe that's a tick in its favor.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to hearing how it drives. Anyway, it looks great. And so we don't have very many actual two-door sports or Gran Turismo or sports cars. So that's could be a good, decent option. But So there were a few price increases in the news this week of at least three different EV models. So I thought it'd be worth at least talking about for a moment. So first, the Hyundai Ioniq 5 price is going up by about $1,500 across the different trim levels. So this means the base price with the destination charge figured in is going to be like $42,745. So the Ioniq 5 SE model with a larger battery pack and more range now starts at $46,795. So I think, that's maybe okay. It's kind of understandable. There's like a supply chain battery commodity cost. The cost of lithium is huge and increasing. So it's kind of understandable that $1,500, yes, it's up. But next, the Audi Q4 e-tron and Sportback got price increases just as they go on sale here. So originally, it was supposed to start at $43,900, and now it's $4,900 more. So starting at $48,800, and if you want the all-wheel drive version, that's $53,800. That seems like a bridge too far for me. Like personally, nudges way up into a different class of vehicle, but I know we can talk about this in a second, but I just want to mention this last one. So finally, the Ford F-150 Lightning Pro got its second price increase. So Ford previously raised prices on all its trims by $7,000 to $8,000. Now the Pro model is $5,000 more on top of that, bringing the base price of the Lightning up to $53,769. Now, all of these, this last one kind of like hurts the most, because that's what I would buy given the choices, personally, and it is a great value. But so I mentioned on Twitter yesterday that Ford could be in a tricky situation next year when the Chevy Silverado EV comes out. Its base price has been given as $40,000, which is what the Ford Pro was originally. So lots of people made the case that this price would increase by the time it comes out next year, which is a valid possibility. But even if it does, I have a hard time imagining it being raised by, $14,000. So Tom, with this new price, is the Pro still a decent value? And do you have any thoughts on the price raises happening at GM?
So You know, we're seeing price raises across the board in many companies now. Those are going to continue. It's simple economics. We all know the cost for everything is going up. I mean, you go to a restaurant these days and you're paying more for that steak than what you paid 8 months ago. It, across the board, I'm a little disappointed that Ford did this twice. They had to know when they did this last price increase, what was it, a month ago, 3 weeks ago, whatever it was, that wasn't going to be sustainable. I don't know what would have changed in a couple of weeks for them to decide, oh, wait a minute, you know, we miscalculated. We need to raise it even more. But, as far as what it's cost, Kyle and I have said this numerous times. We've both driven the Pros and we've driven the different trims. When I did my range test with the Pro a couple of months ago, yeah, I commented in the video, I say, I bought the wrong Lightning. I should have bought a Pro, not my Lariat. This thing's $41,000. It's ridiculous. I even said this is by far the best deal of any vehicle, not just electric vehicle, you can get. So it was way underpriced at $41,000. That was a ridiculous deal. And I'm, without asking Kyle, I'm sure he's going to echo my thoughts on that. It's probably appropriately priced now at around $50,000. There's no, and I do not believe GM's going to be able to sell that the electric Silverado base model at what they said they were going to sell for $40,000. There's no way. They'll probably wait right until it's available to for you to configure and put your money down and lock in a price with a dealership and raise the price there. There's no reason for them to do that now, because if things get even worse in the next few months, then they'd have to go back and do what Ford did and raise them again. So if I'm GM, I'm just going to sit and wait until they really are ready to start selling. I know a lot of people are saying, well, GM is selling them at this price. You go to the GM website, you see that's our suggested retail price. I don't think anybody's locked in a price at a dealership. Like, nobody signed a contract yet. And they just have a reservation at a suggested price. So, I fully expect that to get raised before that goes on sale. I don't think it's possible for them to sell that much vehicle for $40,000 and Ford learned they can't.
Yeah. Kyle, what do you think?
No still question. Value? Tom's sentiment about that $40,000 truck when it launched, it had 100 kilowatt-hour battery pack, 2 motors, 0 to 60 in a crazy time, almost 10,000 pounds of payload, maybe not on that exact configuration, or not payload, excuse me, towing capacity. That was like, how could you spend 40 grand for 100 kilowatt-hour pack, all of that, and then still get a truck attached to it? So I think at least for now, the new pricing is in line with where it honestly probably should be. I don't think it's overpriced at 53,000. Look at the price of most new trucks today. And the Pro, you get a lot of standard equipment. I was a big fan of it. So look, at the end of the day, yeah, kind of a shame the 40K is gone. But I agree with Tom though. Just give us one big wallop of a price increase rather than trying to soften the blows over a few months. That just is, bringing it up in the news over and over with not a good news piece. Like, let's just hit us hard with the Band-Aid off and then get back to the good stories. I don't know, that's not how I would do it, but maybe they have their own reasons. I'm sure they knew this would be the price, of course. I don't think this is a surprise for them.
Right. I'm looking at the F-150 Lightning or F1 regular gas ice combustion F-150s, and they start at 31,520, which is pretty cheap. But of course, that's not a king cab. That's a king cab, or that's a two-door, actually, not even a king cab.
Right, to get the equivalent, you're still it's like 38 or 39,000,
okay,
roughly, forget. The electric one was right in line with the combustion one, though, and that was with, I think, the non-EcoBoost V6, if I'm correct, unless the 2.7-liter standard. Now, I haven't gone through the F-150 lineup in a little while.
Right. Yeah, on the page, they show a lot of two doors and then the king cab, but the four doors, like the King Ranchers, is $60,000, but they've got
you can get a crew cab, the four door short bed in the standard configuration. You don't need to get a King Ranch for that.
Right. Just like in an XL. Right. I just got to dig down deeper into the menu to get that to.
Well, I mean, the pro versions are really meant for commercial use is really what Ford pushes it towards. And you can't, I know we're used to buying vehicles, like one vehicle for ourselves and, you know, our families. And we look at that MSRP, what our monthly payments are, but businesses look at it totally different. They really dig deep into total cost of ownership and running costs. And even at $53,000, if you run the numbers on what it costs to run this thing, say for the maybe a 6-year life period for a commercial truck, you know, for a construction company or something like that, they're going to be way ahead in maintenance and fueling. So, you know, like I said, $40,000 was just stupid cheap before. Even at $53,000 or $54,000, whatever it is now, I'm sure that the fleet managers running their numbers can show that this thing is way cheaper to own and run for a business for 5 or 6 years than a comparable gas vehicle that costs less up front, but that, you know, you're buying gas and you're doing oil changes and you're doing all that maintenance and so forth. So, you know, Ford knows this. Ford has all that data. Ford provides it to their business, their fleet operators. So they knew how far they could push this number and still have a case to their fleet operators to say, look, you're still going to save money. It's just, you're not going to save a ridiculous amount of money like they could before. I know nobody likes price increases, but we all know that's the world we live in now, and it's impossible. We're going to see price increases for everything. We have 4 or 5 vehicles in the news this week, like you're talking about that raised price. You know, you're not going to see a $40,000 Cybertruck. You're not going to see a $40,000 Silverado, in my opinion.
Right.
Maybe I'll be wrong. We'll you know, it's been immortalized here on the podcast. So
it's a good thing to be wrong about. Hey.
If that happens and I'm wrong later on, I'll admit it. But I don't, unless we have some kind of reversal in what's going on with the supply chain, and all the experts I talked to says, this isn't going away. You know, it's not like, oh, in 6 months, we're going to be through this. This is going to take years to improve. So, you know, we'll see.
I wonder why they did it in the first place. I wonder why they went with 40 in the first place, because they didn't need the publicity. They didn't need to do it to get headlines, although it did, and it was brilliant, and it was good for them. I wonder, was 40 the real price? Was it a loss leader? Did they know they were always going to increase? That's a 30% increase in a pretty short amount of time. So I know everything's gone up, but not by that much. So I wonder why, you know, you'd love to be a fly on the wall in those meetings where I guess everyone has an opinion, but who makes that call? Like, let's go 40 to begin with. Because we all said when that vehicle went on sale, it was too cheap. You know, was it just to get column inches written? I can't think that it would, because the vehicle was like every version of the F-150 was so good. It got enough press. I'd love to know what the reason was they went with that, because it was inevitable price rises would come. Was it just to get that initial burst of like shock and awe?
Well, I learned my lesson. I should have reserved that thing on the first day, because even though I wouldn't have been able to foresee how I could possibly afford to buy it, but now I can with the rebate, and I would sell both of my vehicles, because that's a truck, and I don't need another truck if I you know. So I'm just like kicking myself for not doing that first thing. So and then watching it like drift out of farther and farther out of my reach. It's like, oh my God, it's a little frustrating, but you know, whatever.
You could have bought it and sold it, Dom, and then you'd have enough money to buy your Bolt.
Right.
I know. I know somebody here in New Jersey that just flipped their Lightning. They got a Lariat and paid what I did, $80,000, and they had it for a week and just sold it for $96,000. So that's, you know, nice little profit.
Wow,
man, that is pretty nice. Yeah. All right. So anything else we want to talk about? Prices? No, that's fine. That's great. I don't really have a whole lot else, just a few things I wanted to mention. Oh, Tesla's Elon Musk mentioned, I didn't put this in my notes, but Elon Musk mentioned yesterday that the Tesla Semi is going into production finally after all this time. So I guess that means, I don't know. Martin, do you remember what batteries this has? Does it have the 4680s or the 2170s?
Well, look, that's the interesting thing. I have 4680s. That's the interesting thing, isn't it, about the 4680 cells? In that we all watch Battery Day, and it all went over my head, because I'm not a battery expert, and so all these new terms that were introduced. And I'm like, okay, now I need to learn about why all these technologies are going to be crucial for raising performance and raising charging speed and decreasing cost. And then when you look at the Model Ys that have been torn down so far, the Munro Live channel being the best one that I can think of, right. You know, those 4680 cells are simply a change of form factor. They changed the way the tabs are done, which again gets into a bit of the weeds here, but in terms of the tabless design, which is better for efficiency, but they're still the same chemistry. They're still the NCM cells. They're still cobalt rich. That's all meant to go. They didn't have a definite answer on the dry cathode process, but like they're not what was promised. So what I'm interested to see is a Tesla just getting the 4680s out the door, and then over the next few months and years, they're going to eventually get to what was promised at Battery Day, which would make sense as they improve them bit by bit. But certainly all of those, you know, I remember the slides coming up, they're going to be really fast charging and much higher density and much cheaper right. to make. And none of that has come through yet. So I'm right. interested to see, like, is the, how much of the compromise is that to the semi-truck? Because the truck and the Cybertruck definitely needs the improvements that we were promised on those batteries. But the ones that are being taken apart right now are just like big 2170s. Right. So it's interesting to look at.
Did you think at the pack level, though, they made some gains because they don't have to have quite as much like plumbing in the pack or whatever?
Yeah, certainly the way that the structural pack is made with that pink foam of doom that the Munro team had to chip away or blast away. So there's improvements there. So it's not like I'm trying to say that they're not any better than what they had. There has been some small gains, but it's not what we were promised. And it's interesting to see, like, will they ever get to that? Was it all smoke and mirrors? Or is it somewhere normally with Tesla halfway between, like, you know, they'll make those improvements and get there when they can. But you would think for the truck and the Cybertruck that they would need all of that and more to get some decent range and to sell them at a half decent price.
Yeah. Right. It's kind of a mystery to me until like you said, I expected to see a good change, like a big improvement with these new cells, and I haven't really seen it yet. So I'm not sure why they had to wait for these cells to make the truck, but they did. But now I guess they have enough production of the 4680 cells to get these things on the road. And I mean, that's a good thing. It's going to displace some diesel trucks out there. And yeah, living by the highway, I'm looking forward to quieter trucks.
Yeah,
myself. Right. So Rivian released its production and sales results for Q3 2022. And I just want to mention this briefly because they put out 7,363 electric vehicles, which is 67% more than Q2, which is a good raise. And deliveries were 6,500, up 47% compared to Q2. So that's pretty good. Just want to mention that and say congratulations to them. Is that a convincing enough number, do you think, Tom, for the doubters out there?
So, well, it depends on how serious of a doubter you are. It's enough for me. I had mentioned, you know, after the last, quarter results that, you know, we want to see marketed improvement, and we have. And they continue to ramp up, which is really what you see. As far as how much they ramped up, I don't think that's as important, just to see quarter over quarter improvement, as opposed to kind of what we've seen with Lucid, where there was stagnation and maybe even a pullback, where, you know, they don't seem to be really, you know, making these big leaps forward each quarter. We haven't seen their Lucid's third quarter report yet. We're all waiting for that. At least I haven't seen it. Maybe it was out and I missed it. But, you know, this is good news for Rivian. It's showing that they are ramping up and they're getting the vehicles out the door. They've got a lot of reservations and they need to get them out the door. And it seems like they will. And if they can achieve the 25,000 units that they projected in 2022, that's a good number. I know they've pulled back already on that, but if they can hit that, listen, 25,000 vehicles in your first year of production is in my opinion, outstanding. If you've never built a vehicle before, we've seen all these other startups. Nobody's been able to make that many vehicles in their first year. So if they do, then kudos to Rivian. I think it's a huge win.
And good vehicles too, like you were talking about last week. You know, people are raving about the R1S, and you both own an R1T, Kyle and Tom, and still great, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's little issues with it here and there. I mean, the tonneau cover is they're recalling that, they're going to be replacing it all, but that's kind of separate from the truck. You know, it's like an appendage to the truck. And there's some software glitches here and there. Sometimes I walk up to it and it doesn't open. It doesn't present, even though I have the key. I have to take my phone, open my phone. There's been times where I've had the key and I've walked away from it and it didn't lock, and I come back to the vehicle. 10 minutes later, and I can see as I'm approaching, the lights have been on the whole time. The door handles are open. It never locks. Somebody could have just hopped in it. So there's some gremlins in it, but overall, I'm very happy with it.
Can you quickly lock it? Like, you have a little thing on your phone?
Of course you could. Yeah. Even in the key fob, you could lock it, but I'm used to just walking away and having it lock itself when I leave the perimeter, you know, and so it on rare occasion, I've noticed it hasn't. It usually does, but
I think the key itself isn't proximity. It's just your phone that is.
Yeah,
so
I know.
If you have the app open on your phone, then it works.
Yeah, but you have to open the app. You have to keep the app
running, just like Tesla, though. Tesla doesn't work if it's closed. So it's the same for me, Tesla or Rivian, with the phone app. But when I have just the key to the truck, which is often, sometimes I'm just sitting there like an idiot trying to unlock the truck and it to notice that I'm there.
Right.
Well, I haven't had, with my Model 3, I didn't have to open my phone app to have it unlock, Kyle. When I walked away from it, my phone was in my pocket. It would just lock automatically.
Yeah, so the app can be in the background, but it just needs
to be running in the background.
Yeah. But with Rivian, same thing. It just needs to be running in the background. Maybe it's a weird glitch because you're an Android user, right? So I don't know that world too well. So at least with iPhone, I have to keep the app open in the background for it to unlock either Tesla or Rivian.
Yeah. I mean, the weird thing is it does it most of the time. And I'm not changing. I'm not manually closing. Like, it does it most of the time, but just every now and then I walk away and it doesn't lock. I come back to the car. I didn't even realize it didn't lock itself. And like a few days ago, I went to this coffee shop and I walked in, I got my coffee and I came out. And as I'm walking, I could see the vehicle far away. It's way out of the range where it should have unlocked. I see the door handles are open. I'm like, oh, wow, that thing never locked. And, just walked up to it and went in. So I don't know. It seems like it does sometimes and it doesn't other times. I haven't been able to figure out exactly why.
I'm just looking at the chat. People are talking about whether the app has to be open for the Tesla to lock. And Pete saying, yep, the app must be open on iPhone for Tesla. On Android, we just had to have, this little T at the top of your phone. Mm-hmm. And you just touch it and I've got a bunch of stuff on my phone I was screwing up with. Anyway, it's been the Tesla works fine, like unlocking. Actually, I have to, sometimes it doesn't unlock when I approach with my phone. I need to, find the thing and press unlock on my phone. But yeah, but walking away, it seems to work. But speaking of cars getting out the door and shipping, the Cadillac Lyriq has shipped 36 models this month and this quarter, actually. So those are the first Cadillac Lyriqs on the road. So have we heard about any media loans for this car yet? Because I'm really dying to see you guys at doing a highway range test.
No, not for me yet.
Okay, that's something to keep an eye out for.
I wonder why we've seen so little of this car in terms of online.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool profile, right?
Early adopters tend to be, some of them, let me be careful what I say, early adopters tend to sort of want to say, hey, look at the shiny thing that I've got, whether that is with, blogs or posts and things on the internet. And so remember when they were offering $5,000 off the price of this car to the early buyers if you signed an NDA and they had permission to watch where you go, how you use it, how you charge it. They could learn about how people use electric cars. I wonder if the first ones are going to people have all agreed not to talk about it. I don't know. I have no insight. That's a complete guess.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. But I really look forward to seeing some on the road. It's true. Like often with these electric vehicles, and this is like an important one because it's like, you know, it's the first normal size vehicle on the Ultium package. The Hummer is like a special case, the Hummer EV. It's an Ultium vehicle. But for me, in my mind, like that's a whole separate thing, right? But this is like the first of many Ultium kind of vehicles following like this similar size and packaging. And so it's kind of an important vehicle, and I'm surprised that we haven't seen like owners. Maybe I'm looking in the wrong places, but I don't know. Anyway, look forward to hearing.
It's only 36. Not everybody has a YouTube channel and tweets. You know, it could just be just regular people that just want to check out their Lyric by themselves.
Right. They did a profile of the first dealership to get one, and I think that was the number one. They sell more than any other. That's why they got preferential treatment. And they kind of profiled the car turning up on the back of the low loader, whatever it was. And then they said it sat in the showroom for like, I think it was like 12 minutes or 14 minutes or something, because they put it in the showroom. They got it ready and dressed. No one could touch it because it's a sold car. And then the training team or the engineering team turned up from head office to start teaching all the engineers and the technicians about how to work on the electric vehicles. They had to take it off the showroom floor and take it back. So I think it was on display, but you couldn't get anywhere near it because it was a sold car. So it was, you know, they have done some press and some stuff around that first car, but otherwise been very, very quiet about it.
Right. Nebula 1707 says there's the Cadillac Lyric owner on the Cadillac forums, which that has been describing their car every day. They did not sign the NDA. Nebula is also on the Inside EVs forum, but we don't have any Lyric owners there yet, which is kind of disappointed. I really was hoping we get some Lyric owners. Maybe we still will, but yeah. So the only other thing I really have, like news wise, and maybe you guys have something that I'm missing, but I thought this was worth mentioning. Tesla's decided to remove its ultrasonic sensors from its cars, from like the Tesla Model 3s and Model Ys, at least for now, the cars it's manufacturing now. I think they'll keep their functionality in the existing fleet, but new cars, but it's like pure vision, no ultrasonic sensors. That seems a little crazy to me. I don't know. Tom, any thoughts?
So, you know, I'm not a driver assist engineer.
Right.
It just seems like it can't be better to have less technology, you know, and putting it as simple as you can, not having ultrasonic sensors, not having LiDAR, I don't know how that's better than having it, you know. And it seems like most other companies agree that, you know, having a suite of backup systems is better, but Tesla seems to know what they're doing with this. They've been at this trying to achieve autonomous driving, you know, harder than any other company. And, I don't know. Kyle's done a lot of work with Tesla's ADAS. And, I'm interested to hear his point of view on this. It seems to me like, you know, you won't get there with just cameras. But as I said, I'm not an engineer in this stuff. It just, it really surprises me that this is the direction they're going in.
Right. Because, like, I don't know, driving the Tesla in the rain, I get the cameras aren't functioning anymore. And they can't, you know, we get like error messages like this. So I don't know how you get rid of sensors.
And in fog, you know, there's a lot of conditions where the cameras can't see. So, there's got to be a reason behind it. You know, we are all armchair engineers saying this is the wrong decision to make, but again, I'm not one of these, you know, engineers that work on this. There's got to be a legitimate reason behind why they're saying they don't need this other tech.
Kyle, is this the wrong decision to make?
Hard to say, too early to tell. I think they should have waited for feature parity before removing the parking sensors, because my understanding is some of the cars, the first cars that have the ultrasonic sensors removed, won't have all the full functionality that the cars today do. So there are some ways around it. My guess is we're actually going to see when they remove the ultrasonic cars, when that starts production, we might see a front bumper camera because right now there's no way to easily see in front of the hood for the cameras. And certainly you can, like, if you park the car, it can remember what was there and then try and move forward. But like if a dog walks there or your child walks there, the car just wouldn't know without any other sensors. We've also seen on the Cybertruck a front bumper camera. So I think that might get added to the suite, which would be kind of interesting. They're already having to remold the bumpers, right, without the sensor. So they've gone to make a supplier change. They can add in the camera spot. That's just a prediction. Look, at the end of the day, Tesla is all in on vision, at least for the moment. I don't think the high definition radar systems have made it in their cars yet, or maybe these will allow a retrofit into the bumper. Maybe they already have a place. We got to pull one off and see how it's all, produced. But everyone else that I talk to in the driver assistance world says Tesla's wrong, Tesla's wrong, Tesla's wrong. Tesla says we're doing this the only way, the right way. And honestly, it's a little bit too early to tell. From my side, I think it's easy to just say Tesla's making the wrong decision and move on. But ultimately, we don't know for sure. And, you know, there's also different levels of safety that we can predict that they're giving up on by not having redundant sensors in there. But again, humans do drive only with eyes. I get that argument. My gut feeling says the more sensors, the better. I'm not an expert in this at all. But Tesla's done some amazing things so far with vision only, some really bad things too, but some pretty amazing things up to this point. So all my recommendation can be is just like always, when you're using the system, eyes up, pay attention, ready to take over. And it's kind of fun to play around with all this stuff. Where it gets sketchy is when people rely on the systems too much.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I guess we'll have to see how it all works out. I just realized too, I didn't put this on the news, and it's not really a car thing, but it is like Tesla, they released their Optimus robot. That was like after our show last week, right? That happened?
I know we don't go big on Tesla's quarterly stuff, but that was a Sunday night, was the quarterly numbers as well. So
right.
That for me, that was the story of the week. Really,
but it had big production. Yeah, great production record again, right?
Basically. Yeah, a new record-breaking quarter for 3 and Y. S and X continue to be a rounding error. I'm so surprised they make those vehicles, because if they're as brutal as taking out ultrasonic sensors, if they're as brutal as taking out lumbar support on a passenger seat, then what are they doing making S's and X's? Like it's so irrelevant to the company. I'm glad they do, by the way. I was just asking the question. I hope they always make them because they're great machines. But they're so insignificant to the success of that company. If the whole business is about threes and whys, arguably about whys. But there was also a Reuters report that spoke to two people with knowledge of the matter. They say, I trust that source, single source, I trust it though. And they said that they've seen Tesla's goal for Q4 of 495 vehicles, which would put 2023 on an annual run rate. When Berlin and Austin have scaled and Shanghai's going to be a million a year, of 2 million vehicles. And that puts Tesla shy of BMW.
Yeah.
And when you look at that headline, that's just incredible for a new, for what is in my head still a startup, for Tesla to be almost as, if they can hit their targets, and I think 9 times out of 10 they do. Eventually,
basically selling two models, as you said, through, Martin.
Right. Two cars, yeah. Cars, like a handful of colors, and that's it.
It's quite a story.
Amazing. I was just blown away by that. 2 to 2.1 million vehicles next year, and this isn't a financial podcast. And I know that that all gets tied up with share prices and all the people that love to go in on that. And there's a whole industry of out there that analyzed it. But from just the perspective of how amazing is it that there will be a company in the world making premium vehicles? You can't get in for less than. What's the base? It's just called Model 3 these days, isn't it, in the US? Like $50,000? Like, it's not like they're making $20,000 cars.
Right. So no, they're not cheap.
Massively premium vehicles, and they'll sell, if they go to plan, almost be bigger than BMW. What a headline. That's amazing. That for me, that was the story of the week. Like, the delivery numbers was absolutely huge, and they just keep rationalizing and getting it's like Toyota in the 70s, just redefining how to make cars.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily agree with that, by the way. I don't necessarily agree of commoditizing. I love cars. So the idea that they become this soulless piece of glass and this great performance, but, you know, just this thing that you drive because you have to get somewhere, and taking all the interest out. I would still buy, you know, a BMW i4 over a Model 3. But that's amazing. That is amazing. Oh, and the other thing I thought I'd bring up as well, I was watching a Bjørn Nyland, the Norwegian YouTuber, video, and he had a Model 3 with the LFP pack, and he was doing some, he's got some portable battery chargers in his boot, and he's doing a series of videos of running cars down till they break down. Not that I necessarily agree with that, because I think it creates a negative perception that EVs run out of batteries, but either way. And he did it with the LFP pack, and it went 50 kilometers after the dash said zero.
Well, so, 30 miles.
Like, that's because he had the Tesla Spy. What's it called? Tesla, the iOS app or the Android app.
Tom,
I have it too, and I can't remember.
Tesla Fly?
Something like that. And the car just kept going.
Scan my Tesla.
And the voltage was dropping and dropping a little bit by a little bit. And then after like 50 kilometers after zero on the dash, the car was like, bang, stop. The dash went red. The car just it put itself into neutral and wouldn't move. There was no, like, he was still getting 204, 205 kilowatts of available power out of it. Like it wasn't gradually going down and then struggling to get up hills. It was full beams. And then, that's it. So it's really interesting. I find it interesting from a consumer point of view that people who don't care about these things would experience this in one day and be like, well, that's a bit weird. But the dark art of, I don't know, cell voltages and BMSs.
Right. It's just to reach back again, just talking about the Tesla sales record again, just to put it in a more just interesting light. So there's a guy on Twitter. He's a Tesla bull. He's very bullish on Tesla, and he puts a lot of financial predictions and different things. But he put up this chart together yesterday. His name's James Stevenson. He's I cannot underscore enough on Twitter. And he put out this chart, U.S. light vehicle sales year-to-date Q3 2022 versus prior year. And Tesla's like 47% increase. And Ford is just a hair down, only 1%, but then BMW 6% less production over this time, and it just gets worse until you get down to Honda is like 38% less production than, you know, year over year. So that's like supply chain problems and other issues, you know, affecting them. But that Tesla has managed to overcome those obstacles, and it just makes that result, you know, that much more stunning in my mind. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about what we've been driving this week. So I think on my thumbnail, I talked about driving the Mercedes EQS SUV for the first time, but we may have talked about that last week. I was on vacation, so I don't know. My mind wasn't. Anyway, so, but Kyle, I don't know if you wanted to say anything about, because you just put that video up a few days ago on your channel. This is why I mentioned it. I don't know, is there anything about that car that you wanted to mention while we're here?
Yeah, the EQS SUV is, I think, a better EQS version, in my opinion. The EQS sedan was a pretty big fan of a lot of things about that car, but specifically the room in the back was very low. I couldn't actually fit in the back seat, and I thought that was kind of a shame. And so the EQS SUV now, usable second row, usable third row, very luxurious. Almost and probably just near makes no difference, just as quiet as the sedan. One of the most quiet, luxurious electric cars on sale, taking the very Mercedes electric approach, which is big rear wheel steering, big steering wheel, big displays, everything integrated with software, works really well. Route planning, plug and charge, and battery pack preconditioning. Really good EV stuff, very efficient in my testing as well for an SUV. Might be the gold standard electric SUV at this moment. I mean, it's really, if you want a rugged 7-passenger SUV, you go Rivian R1S. If you want a luxurious one, you go EQS SUV. And those are the options at the moment, in my opinion. It's a little bit more expensive than e-tron, and but a lot bigger. E-tron will really probably compete with the smaller version of the EQS SUV that will launch at some point in the near future. Yeah, overall, just blown away by this thing. Really a big fan, and it's perfect. It's like the perfect soccer mom SUV. I think it's really great.
Yeah, so they make a EQ. So this is the EQS SUVs. They also make the EQE, and so it makes sense that they'll probably make an EQE SUV as well, right? I don't know. Is that public or?
I don't know what I can and can't say. So right. I'm going to.
Yes, it's happening. I can say that because.
Okay. Right.
So, I mean, it makes sense.
So, yeah, it is. Yeah, and that's going to be a price point which will get more people inside it. So
right.
I think I can also say that I've been able to play around with it, but I can't talk about what anything I experienced.
Yeah. Right. Right. But this starts at like $104,000, I believe.
I got it.
It's very reasonable. Very reasonable. Okay. I think it's a good price.
In the EQE that you've had not with the mega screen, with the just like the center screen, and it looks so much better. So much better.
Yes. I can't
get over it.
Stop putting hyper screens in these cars because they're really not that better. I really like the small screen. It can do everything. There's no functional difference between the two, really. Right. And so we have on test this week, we've actually had it for a couple of weeks, the Mercedes EQE 350 4MATIC, which is just the smaller version of the EQS and more reasonably priced. And
all-wheel drive?
Yeah. One we have is all-wheel drive.
Yeah, rear steer?
How's it?
Yeah, 10 degrees of rear steer.
Okay.
How's it been charging on those new EA stations that you, the updated ones you've got?
Yeah, so I haven't charged the EQE yet. All the guys have been working with it. I'm going to play around with it this weekend. But the new EA stations that have been upgraded near my home, which are the new BTC units with BTC cabinets, have been truly flawless. No issues at all. Pump out full juice. Saw 351 kilowatts delivered to the Lucid Air for a short peak. So, you know, over what it says on the sticker. So that's pretty good for a short period. And people have been using them every day. I've been using them all the time because I was towing with the Rivian. We were doing some charge testing, you know, bouncing all around. We've been really putting them through their paces. Not one activation issue, full speed every time. Huge fan of the new stations.
Kyle, have you tried to charge two vehicles at the same time that can pull more than 150 kilowatt just to watch what each station dispenses?
I don't believe our station is balanced. We have three individual charging cabinets that we believe feed 350 kilowatts direct to each station. They are indicated that they are balanced on the display, but even with everyone there, I've never not been able to pull full power. So I see no indication that it's balanced. However, we should be getting the Hummer EV soon and we'll have the Lucid Air. Then we'll know. We'll just plug both in dead and see what happens.
That'd be a great test.
Well, don't worry. If your experience is anything like mine with the Hummer EV, it won't pull much. I'm still, by the way, waiting for clarification on GM. I've been in constant contact with them. We've traded a lot of emails. We showed the charging curve that I had in my Hummer EV charging session a couple of weeks ago here on the show. It pulled about 200 kilowatt for a short period of time, then dropped down and hummed along at like, I think it was 135, I forget, whatever. But I never saw anything more than 200 kilowatt. And it only did that for like 5 minutes. So it definitely wasn't the charging station limiting it. It could have been the vehicle, could have had some sort of an issue. I preconditioned it. The battery was nice and warm. So it wasn't that. So I'm waiting to hear back from GM. But my early experience charging the Hummer EV has been less than you know what I expected.
Right. So
with the Lucid charging, sorry, I just wanted to mention this really quick talking charging. Sure. Have done multiple charging sessions with the Lucid now, logging different curves. I have to put all the data together and make a video, but it really doesn't seem to be as impressive as we were hoping. We've seen a peak of 351 kilowatts. The car does not have the big 2.0 software update that's rolling out, by the way. This is news. Lucid finally gets lane centering to customer cars as of yesterday, is my understanding. So, well, it took him about time because a base Honda Civic has this technology. So, anyway, we got to try that out, run it through the hogback. Our car has not gotten the update yet. So I don't know what's up with that. Everyone else on Twitter seems to have it. So, I'm going to the Lucid Service Center today because we're putting the performance wheels and tires on it because they were concerned and I was concerned, like, hey, this thing's on the aero wheels that we're testing, the 19 inches, and they have no grip for performance driving. It's not dangerous. It's just an aero wheel and tire package.
Sure.
And they're like, I was like, guys, like, if you want like a, can you send a set of these big wheels out here? Cause I really want to test the car in the canyons and maybe bring it to the track as well and see what it does. You know, it's not a performance spec, but it is important to feel how the car handles and everything. So we got to get the good rubber on. When I'm there, I'm going to see if they can just force the update to this car, because I really want to do the hogback with this new lane centering functionality.
Oh, speaking of charging Hummers, a viewer says, I've only charged my Hummer DC twice, both times 256 peak to 60% state of charge, which sounds pretty good, which sounds different from your experience.
I'm expecting it to be like that, to be honest with you, but I can only report on what I've seen. You know, I drained it down to zero. I was trying to record a full charging session. It kept charging and then shutting off. I had to drain it back down again. And then when I finally got it to run, you know, it pulled, it was climbing to 200 kilowatt, and then it just dropped way down to like 40 kilowatt. And then it went back up to like 135 or whatever and held that the whole time. So it was extremely disappointing. I'm sure the vehicle can do better, but until I see it do better, you know, I have to be skeptical. I've sent GM, as we said, multiple emails. We're going back and forth. I sent them my full charge recording, and their engineers are looking at it now, and they're going to give me a response.
Hey, so, Kyle, just to move along here, you drove the Lucid Air Grand Touring, and you did so, and you've had this car for a little bit now, and you've done a 70 mile an hour highway range test on the 19 inch aero wheels that you mentioned. So no easy task, because this thing needs, like, you know, a stretch of road the size of Wyoming, which is handy for you because you live right by Wyoming. And so how did it do? This is something that I believe that Tom's also driven, right? But he got a very different result. So.
Yeah, so we can get into comparing Tom's results to mine certainly later on. I'll let you know at least how my test went, how everything went. You know, at the end of the day, I really hate range tests because they're just the most boring thing on the planet. And I really actually don't think they help the end user at all. I really think it's the dumbest thing we do, because cars all go far enough. It's all about how quickly they charge, in my opinion. But people watch the video, so I did it. Okay, so full charge the car, DC charged it to 100% until it clicked off. 70 mile an hour loop test went, up into the normal loop into Cheyenne, over through I-80 into Nebraska. We looped around. We were, instead of storm chasing, storm avoiding. and so we had pretty good tests, but the live stream viewers were amazing. Specifically, this one person on there, Sandy, huge shout out to them for just helping it. Like, hey, there's a storm in 20 miles. Take this exit, go back another 80 miles, then flip around because that storm's coming in on the other side. And we just knifed our way through all these storms. It was amazing. We hit rain for only about, I would say, 1 mile of drizzle, and then maybe a quarter mile where it just came down and then it was done. So it definitely wasn't that's not going to affect the test that much. So I can't say at all. Maybe at 1/10 of 1 mile would be my guess, something like that. You can quote me on that. Range tests are dumb, but people watch them. They all go far enough. Tom took a Mini Cooper SE from New Jersey to North Carolina. You don't need these big range cars, but this thing goes really freaking far. It got 4 miles per kilowatt hour at 70 miles an hour, which is 250 watt hour per mile. This is a big sedan, very impressive. And I have to note, this is a customer car. This is not a car Lucid like made sure the body panels were good on or greased this, that, I don't know, but it's just that this is a full production car. It had 4,000 miles on it. The trunk doesn't fit quite right. So it's like not totally aero slipstreamed. And, I'm just really blown away by how it did really well. Now, just to confirm the 4 miles per kilowatt hour thing, I ran the car in a loop yesterday at 70 miles an hour, leaving from the same place, Cheyenne and back, which is what I typically do because I'm filming the difference in efficiency between the small wheels and the big wheels, and I want to run the same road. And I got 4.1 miles per kilowatt hour. And so we're right in the money there. Maybe we would have gotten another few miles with better conditions, but our conditions were really good. It was 65 degrees almost the entire time. A little bit of wind counteracted by looping around. Of course, it's never perfect. There's always something that happens on the range test, but it was as good as we could expect. You can go back and watch the live stream. Every inch of the drive is totally recorded. And I pulled in at full throttle, wouldn't go faster than 15 miles an hour. The whole car was completely out of juice. The BMS had some confusion. It was indicating 3 miles of range or 4 miles of range for like 7 or 8 miles. Okay. So definitely it was out as far as my right foot showed. I was able to drain, at least according to their software, 109 kilowatt hours out of the battery pack. And it was on 109 for a little while. So my guess is that's mid to high 109 out of it. I think there's probably 1 kilowatt hour of buffer in the Grand Touring pack and maybe 2 kilowatt hours of degradation, which would bring us up to the 112 numbers. That's just a guess. I think really got everything out of the pack possible. Couldn't have done anything more. I gave this car every last possible chance. Came in with 435.5 miles. What's more impressive than any of that is Alyssa, before I was leaving, I said, how far do you think this thing will go? And she said 436 miles. And she was right on the money. I mean, is just, I don't know how she came back from the future. But, you know, the idea of this range test is not to simulate real world. It's not to say this is what you'll get, you know, driving down the highway. People drive faster than 70 miles an hour. It's just to put each car in a similar condition and run them back to back. Now, Tom got 500 miles on the nose in his Lucid Air range test, but this is a different car. That was a Dream Edition range. Also, one thing, and I reached out to Lucid about this just to confirm everything yesterday, Tom got 117.9 or almost 118 kilowatt hours out of the pack. The car itself is only a 118 kilowatt hour pack total, I believe, maybe a tiny bit of buffer in there. But that car had, what, 5,000 or 6,000 miles? So no degradation at all. Just seems weird to me. I confirmed that with Lucid. They said, yep, no degradation. I'm like, that doesn't seem possible. Anyway, the test that Tom got was a different car, different place, similar conditions. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm having a bit of a trouble understanding why they're so far apart. You'd think, okay, when you calculate the degradation on our car and everything, it's still a 40, and you add the extra capacity that you had, it's still a 40 mile difference. And you got 4.3 miles per kilowatt hour versus my 4.1 that it was teeter tottering at. Tom, what do you think is the difference between these two cars? Same wheels and tires, similar mileage. What's your guess?
So a couple of things. You averaged 4.0, 4.1. I was bouncing between 4.2 and 4.3, and it finished it up with 4.3 at the end. And, you know, I pulled off the highway at 496 miles, and I drove the last 4 miles at speeds under 70 miles an hour because I was driving around the mall where the charging station was, and that pushed me up, the slightly slower speed pushed me up to the average of 4.3. And as you mentioned, I had about 9 more kilowatt hours. So that's one thing. Second thing, I also think that, and I'm not sure about this, do you know if the Dream Edition range has like slightly different aero than the vehicle that you had, than the Grand Touring? Is there any difference in the front? Yeah. So anyway, it could be that. You know, on every range test, you could take your car back out on that same course, and and you're not going to end up with 435. You might end up with 428. You might end up with 446. You know, we've done this before. You and I have range test the same cars in different conditions. We're usually pretty tight, but there's been cases, like the Rivian R1T, for instance, where we were 45 miles apart. And, you know, every range test in every condition is slightly different. One of the things I can think of is, you know, I was driving in traffic. I was driving in circles around Scottsdale. It was like a 100-mile circle. I was driving around Scottsdale, Arizona, and I'm in tight traffic. You know, I had to change lanes because sometimes the slow lane was dipping below 70. So I had to get over and pass, like I saw you pass the truck. And I'm driving in a pack of vehicles. So there might have been some additional drafting going on. You were all alone out on, you know, the American plains. You know, you were battling the wind yourself. So it could have been the fact that I'm driving next to trucks, behind trucks, next to cars, in a big moving pack of vehicles. Just think,
over 500 miles, it's not inconceivable to add another 20 or 30 miles. You know, you put that on top of the fact that I had 9 more kilowatt hour of usable energy than you did. And now all of a sudden you're in 490, you know, ish from the 435. So it's not that much of a difference when you look at it. You know, if this, if we were drove EVs that had 200 miles of range and we were 60 miles apart, you know, it's a little bit more wonky than this, in my opinion. That's my final stats there. Oh no, it's Kyle's final stats. Mine, I ended up with 500.1 miles on the nose, and the my trip meter said 117 kilowatt hour, but that turned 117 4 miles before I ended the trip. So I pretty much drove it to the 118 that the vehicle had. And I mean, I don't think I had another 10th or 2/10 of a mile left in it. Like you, I drove it till it had nothing left. And the Dream Edition range has a bigger battery. So I think a couple of, I think that's it really what, how you can say, look at this difference, bigger battery, different driving conditions. You know, we always say, Kyle and I always say, you can't take our range tests as it's like, you know, etched in stone, like it's the Bible. This is what you, close to what you would expect to see if you were driving in similar conditions on similar roads as we were. It's always going to change. And, you know, we saw a good difference here, but there's explanations for it.
Yeah, very cool. I mean, the Grand Touring 435 miles, let's just say 380 to 400 driving like a normal person on the highway. I mean, driving back from California, the car was not predicting I'd get 400 miles of range driving through the desert at 90 to whatever number that I was cruising at. And so, you know, the cruise control only goes to 90, which in like the middle of Utah is not enough. I say the same about Tesla too, but that's, you know, these are small problems. Yeah, you're not going to get 400 miles range driving that way. But in the 70 mile an hour test, I at least was really impressed with 4 miles per kilowatt hour. Again, between 4 and 4.1 is really good. You know, less than 2% degradation on my car and 4,000 miles, lots of DC charging, very impressive. Still don't understand how Tom's car didn't have any degradation with 5 or 6,000 miles, but maybe the Dream's range has some magic in the battery pack that we don't know about. They certainly don't have a buffer that they're eating into, because I remember talking to Lucid engineers a year ago, them saying, look, you can use almost all that battery pack. I find it hard to believe there wasn't any degradation. But anyway, got everything out of that. The result Tom got, 500 miles, was incredible, of course. That's a long one. I think I was impressed that I didn't have to use the restroom during my range test. So that was a nonstop situation straight through. And, you know, I had planned for that, though. I was like, no fluid intake before this thing. You know,
I did stop once at the halfway. And it was really just to grab something to eat, too. And it was right off the highway. You know, it was like pull off, drive about 200 feet, shut power to vehicle down. So it didn't affect the range test at all. And, you know, my bladder's about 25 years older than yours, Kyle. So,
well, if anything, you know. I think it probably helped the range test, because it probably gave the BMS a chance to calibrate mid-pack, which is what, you know, I think is representative of, again, what a normal person would go through. I think just draining the battery from full to dead with a constant load on it at 70 miles an hour is what freaked out my BMS in the car that I have. It also had some weird behavior before that as well. So, lots of range, very efficient, no question. Very impressed. I'm actually putting the aero wheels onto my Model S later today, and I'm going to see what that thing does. Maybe in its range test. I don't think we've ever range tested a Plaid with aero wheels, so maybe I'll just do that while I'm at it. But I'm really curious about its efficiency when compared to Lucid Air Grand Touring.
Right. This must have very.
Nobody, 1 second, Dom. Nobody. I don't carry extra weight than Kyle. I might have a little more around the waist, but he's 5 or 6 inches taller than me. So no, I didn't. I wasn't carrying more weight.
No. If anything, I brought some extra snacks with me
Martin,
too.
Put Buddy in a 15-minute timeout.
Yeah. He's gone. He is gone. I've got to say, the live stream were a little bit too preoccupied with when you were going to pee. I mean. They were.
This was the only topic for
all I cared about.
Hours.
Yep. All right.
Yeah.
I missed that live stream. It was fun. I saw one the other day you did with Alyssa. It was like, was it? It was a huge amount of about like 10 hours or more of live streaming.
I've just been live streaming if we're just sitting in the car, because it's fun to interact with our audience.
Sure.
We want to get motoring back. The videos going on that particular channel. And we drove back from Seattle and live streamed that for 2 days straight, basically, which was really fun. And then just recently, Alyssa and I live streamed for 6 or 7 hours. We dropped, I have a classic car I brought in to get serviced. And so we just towed it in with the Rivian, which was really fun. And overall, yeah, we're having a blast doing it. But back to the Lucid conversation, that car, can I just mention, I got out of the Lucid yesterday and into my Model S. So much more comfortable in the Lucid than the Model S. Quieter, a little bit better seating position, but still not great. Round steering wheel, very nice. The Lucid, on the range test, the suspension on it, everything was a joy to drive for that long.
Nice. Right on. So, Tom, so what you've been driving, you drove last week, and you published an article on the Audi Q4 e-tron, the first drive. Did we talk about this last week at all?
We didn't. Was the embargo ended right during our podcast. Right. So I could have brought it up, but you know, we had a lot of other things to talk about, so we didn't really talk about it. And they actually, I had it set to go, the article to go live a few minutes after the podcast, but they pushed it up and had it go right at the second the embargo ended. But yeah, so we drove, we had the Audi Q4 e-tron first drive event. We got to drive both the Q4 e-tron Quattro and Q4 Sportback Quattro. And they didn't have the rear wheel drive version at the press event, which I quite honestly, I would have liked to have driven that, but they didn't have that there. That has the longest driving range. I think it's 265 miles for the rear wheel drive version. And it's the least expensive. It starts at 48.8, which is also, as you mentioned earlier, about 4,000 more than what we were promised it was going to start at. And it's still a pretty good deal, if you ask me. I mean, don't forget, you know, Audi's got some pretty good electric vehicles. A big fan of the e-tron, but this the base model of this is $22,000 less than the least expensive regular e-tron that you can get. So there's a huge gap in there of affordability for people that maybe want an Audi and what they can afford. You know, the e-tron, you know, the RS GT, the e-tron Sportback, they're all, you know, well north of $70,000 and even north of $100,000 if you're looking at the GT. So, you know, for Audi fans that want an electric vehicle, this is a great option. And, you know, I think you're going to put it head-to-head to say the Volvo XC40 Recharge and C40 Recharge for the Sportback. That's kind of a perfect comparison because they're available both in SUV and Sportback. I guess the Genesis GV60 is a good head-to-head comparison. I think that price-wise, performance-wise, this fits right in with those. It's not a great performer. Even the high perform the Quattro, the all-wheel drive version goes 0 to 60 in about 5.8 seconds, and I think the rear-wheel drive is about 7 seconds. So it's not a barn burner, but you know, as we say, every EV doesn't have to set a quarter mile record. It's more than fast enough for, you know, most people that would want to drive this. I think it's a good alternative. It's basically the Audi's version of the ID4. It uses the MEB platform. It's got the same battery pack. It shares a lot of components, but it's a luxurious version of it. It's got some cool features. If you get the prestige version, it's got the matrix LED headlights that you can choose between four different looks. The headlights have a different style when they're in a daytime running lamp. It's got some nice options. I think it's a good alternative. I think Audi people that are, you know, Audi fans are going to really like this. And it's starts at 48.8 for the rear wheel drive. The all wheel drive Quattro is, I think, 56 and the 56 and change, and the Sportback's $1,000 more. So
mention that the base ones don't even come with adaptive cruise control, which it does in ID4.
Right.
And no massaging seats available, even though it's the luxury.
Kyle has massaging seats. Jesus.
Yeah, but an ID4 has it, and the nice one doesn't.
I got you. No, it doesn't. Yeah.
Right. And no air suspension. And so it's like, you know, we've spent a lot of time with Q4. And I put Alyssa in this car because we had it for a little while. and she drives the regular e-tron. She's got the full size 55. Mm-hmm. And she went, what a pile of crap is this thing? She was like, get this out of our driveway. She hated it. And I thought it was pretty
$20,000
good.
$20,000 less. You know, it's but not going to have the same amenities.
I used full size e-tron, I think. The thing is, why not? Why would you get this over an ID4? That's what
that's the question. Yeah, that's the reason.
I'll tell you why. There are a lot of people that like Audi, and why do people buy prestige brands? Sometimes it's for the prestige. They think it's an upscale vehicle. They like the appearance of driving an Audi. I have friends that wouldn't consider driving a Volkswagen, but they would drive this. Now I don't prescribe to that same, you know, opinion, but there are people that go for the, why do people buy Maseratis except for the loud noise, Kyle, that you mentioned earlier, you know,
just so the loud noise.
Yeah. So it's the brand, it's that badge. And it is, you know, I love the ID4, but if you gave me this and an ID4 and said, you know, we're going to give you the cars for free, you know, which one do you want to drive? It was quieter. I think the suspension felt better. The interior, in my opinion, is nicer. Not that I dislike the ID4,
I was just playing devil's advocate. I like the Audi UI a little bit better. Actually, someone mentioned they sold their Q4 in the chat because of the software. I thought the software was pretty good in my impression. But I like the Q4 overall. It's not like it's a bad car. It's just a more expensive ID4, and you really got to option it up to get options level parity with ID4.
You do, and it does charge slightly better than the ID4, even with the new ID4 software update.
Yeah, it's talk about it's that still, a little bit. Tell us.
Yeah, the maximum charge rate is they Audi quoted 150 kilowatt, the new ID4 with the new software update is 135. Right, it used to be 125, so now it has 135 kilowatt max charge rate. But as you know, Kyle and I are blue in the face saying don't focus on the max charge rate. Look at the full charging curve. Audi says that the ID4 will, the Q4 will charge from 5% to 80% in 36 minutes. And Volkswagen with the new software says 38 minutes. So they say two minutes faster. I actually was able to do a full 0 to 100% charge recording during the drive. I missed dinner on the dinner night and said, guys, I want to take this down to zero. Usually the manufacturers let you do that. I did. I drove it down so it wouldn't go any further, plugged it in, got a nice clean recording. So that video is going to be up soon on my channel, State of Charge. And it went for me, it took 37 minutes, but I started at zero. But it took from 5 to 80%, took 1 minute longer. If I plugged in at 5% instead of zero, it probably would have matched their 36 minutes. So it does charge to 80% in about 36 minutes, which isn't bad. You know, it's not world record beating. It's not as good as the 70,000 plus e-tron. But, you know, in this range of vehicles, other than, say, the GV60, it's probably as good as it gets in that price range, against its direct competition. The charging is pretty good.
Yeah, but you bring up that GV60, and that's a real interesting point, because by the time you option up a Q4 e-tron into the $60,000 range, you're right up there with GV60, and even the GV60 performance isn't far off of that. Then you get 240 kilowatt charging, a way faster car, way more luxurious car. That's an interesting one. So, Tomas in the comments says the Q4 app is useless. In-car software is not good either. Nav doesn't save favorites, no user profiles, and crashing once a week. Interesting. I'm going to go through and I'm going to test all of that. So I'm supposed to get one back, like, I guess anytime. It's just sitting over at Audi. So, I want to try all that out, and see if it's really that bad, because that sounds pretty terrible.
Right. That's definitely not the experience that Audi wants for its customers. And I believe he said he traded that in.
But here's the thing, like to Tom's point, and I was playing devil's advocate earlier on. If you go ID4 or Q4 e-tron, your ownership, your driving experience, your range, none of that's really going to change one way or another. I think existing Audi customers will feel like they're going down market into this car. If they drive a Q5, this is nowhere near as nice as a Q5. If they drive one of those vehicles, they have to step up into the full-size e-tron to get that Audi level feel. This feels honestly like a Volkswagen with an Audi badge. Not to say it's a bad thing, because the ID4 is uber luxurious and really nice, but the little tunings of Audi are not in this car.
Right. And it's not eligible for the IRA taxing. Well, it's not assembled in the U.S. anyway, so it won't get that part of the package regardless.
Yeah, it loses the tax credit.
Right.
What our dealer was doing recently, and I don't know if others were doing the same thing, similar to like with Lucid or Rivian, you could lock in an order form to reserve your tax credit into the future. Our dealer did that with every Q4 reservation they had on to hopefully... Okay. They think 50-50 shot, but they're hoping that can at least lock in the tax credit for those who have pre-ordered Q4 e-tron here locally.
Right. And this the whole IRA thing. So I'm looking to, you know, buy a Bolt, as you know. Kyle's generously loaned me a car for a while I do this process. Oh, by the way, so I punched in a new got a new quote for my Spark EV. So I put more miles on it than the last time. And I was kind of expecting that it's going to be like a lower price or whatever. I was going to be sad. I was kind of hesitant to put it in because I didn't want to see that number. So I did it. Finally did it, and it's like more. It's almost
well.
Almost
sell 15. It now because the market's getting real soft.
Yeah.
So
no,
just
I'm,
dump it.
Yep. Oh yeah, I'm doing it. It's like I sent the uploaded the copy of the title, and it took a while yesterday to work all that out. But yeah, definitely like. Close to $15,000. I mean, but then I looked at the IRS thing, some of the fine print, and the Bolt isn't eligible for that this year. If I buy it now, but for, you know, I have to wait until January in order to be able to take advantage of the $7,500 tax credit, which I think is what I'm going to have to do. So, in just for 3 months, I'm going to have to take Ubers and I think get my pickup truck running properly. It's not, I need to put the catalytic converter on it.
Kind of like, yeah. Well, okay. Well, we can play it by ear. You can borrow the Model 3 for a bit. I mean,
well,
we
not
just
that long,
get
though.
Back for snow.
I need to get it back to you.
Whenever you feel like doing another road trip, bring it on back. But ultimately, if you need transportation, don't worry about it too much.
Right. No, I need to get the truck working anyway, so I can either use it or sell it. So I can, you know, if I want to go fishing on the coast, I can jump in and go do
and
that.
Remind me why you aren't going for a used Bolt that might need the new battery or like get a new battery for free. I should say like go for the cheapest used Bolt.
Cause I like the second 2.0, the refresh.
Oh, the refresh.
Like
stuff.
So okay. Much better. It's like such a much better interior. It's like night and day.
Yeah. The original but Bolt seriously sell your Spark now because this market, right.
It's way
softening, and it's only going to go real quick. So now is the time to sell. This is your last call. Sell whatever you want to sell, and then wait a couple months, and then buy.
Today I'm putting the doing all that arrangement of the pickup part and all that kind of stuff. I got the stuff uploaded, the documents, and on to the next part. So speaking of Chevy Bolt, real quickly, Tom, you did an EV fast charging analysis. We don't have to spend probably a lot of time on this because we have probably a good idea of how the Bolt EV fast charges, but I don't know.
That term fast very loosely, Dom. Right. So before I jump into that really quick, I have Eric Beyer said, Tom, are you going to do a lightning charging video with the new 80 amp Ford charger that you see behind me here? Not yet, because that's not hooked up. It's just hanging on the wall. I'm doing a 400 amp service upgrade to my house. I can't add it with everything I have here already because that takes 100 amp service. So that's not functional yet. I'm charging my Lightning with the other EVSE that I have here. But as soon as I do, I will. But in the meantime, either today or tomorrow, I'm putting out a deep dive DC fast charging video on my Lightning. Yeah. I've DC fast charged it like 20 times now. All my charging has been DC fast. I really haven't charged it here until this last week. Well, first of all, nothing was working while I was doing the garage renovation. And I recorded like every one of my charging sessions. So I have a ton of DC fast charging. It's going to be like a 45-minute video. I've got all different charts and graphs to show how it pulls different charging power at different state of charges when you plug in. The Lightning charges differently than any other vehicle that Kyle and I have ever tested. It the way it will repeat its same charging characteristics no matter when you plug it in. It's very unique, and we're going to do a deep dive into that. So look for that video today or tomorrow. All right.
So that's soon. That'll be cool.
Yeah.
I'm finishing it up today. I've got a split screen with six DC fast charging sessions at once running, where they all start and each one stops. So it's nice. It's a lot of overdubbing too of me.
But Tom, would you agree that
there's your lightning?
There's my lightning. Still? What's that, Kyle?
Do you think the F-150 charges too slow still?
It should be better, but it's just on the verge of passable. You know, it's not like it's not a disaster. It's not like, oh, this is terrible. It's just good enough because it does, especially because what I'm going to talk about in the video, no matter when you plug it in, you get this boost of power. So that's good for people on road trips. People aren't going to be plugging in at zero like you and I do. And in a lot of EVs, if you plug in at 20% or 25%, you're missing the maximum power, the whole big charging, you know, that chunk when it charges really quickly. In the Lightning, you get it no matter when you plug in. So if you happen to plug in at 40%, boom, for 8 minutes, you're getting 160, 165 kilowatt. Then it drops down to about 120 and it pulls that all the way to 80%. So it could be better, but it's pretty good. And I'm going to explain that in the video. And I see Martin pulled up that. Yeah, that was two nights ago. I thought you guys would get a kick out. That's my Lightning parked in the driveway and a little rodent's walking by it. We get a lot of those up here, actually. And I got to be careful when I'm walking around my property because I could just stumble onto one of those guys.
Bear,
and the funny thing is, what most people don't realize is New Jersey is the most densely populated state in the country for black bear. You would never think that, right? But we have like more bear per square mile than bears any like state in the country, which, you know, most people think of New Jersey, you don't think of being like a rural place where there's forests and wildlife, but there is. And I see a lot of bear up here. I get them passing by all the time. I've got to be careful when I'm walking around my yard.
That's pretty cool.
All right. So we'll talk about the Bolt EV. I did that video went up, Bolt EV DC fast charge test. I recorded actually a long time ago when I did the range test on the Bolt EV and the one I ran out. But I finally was able to spend some time on this now and do it. So the Bolt has a maximum charge rate of 55 kilowatt. Oof. I didn't see that. I saw 49 kilowatt. I know people have reported that they've seen 55 and 54 for a short period of time. But you know, it just, you know, the Bolt EV is a great little EV. Nothing beats it for value, for a new EV, for the price. And most people don't need to drive EVs long distances and need to DC fast charge. But if you do, it's a very poor DC fast charger. It takes 42 minutes, I think, to add back 100 miles of driving range. You know, it's at 50% state of charge, it's before you hit the 50% state of charge, it's already lowering its charge rate. It won't even hold 50 kilowatt beyond 50% state of charge, which is crazy for me. And by the time you get up to 80% or even 75%, it's only pulling like 30 kilowatt. Yeah. So it's I don't know why they can't run that 55 kilowatt up to 80%. It's a big pack. It's a 65 kilowatt hour battery pack. And that would help a little bit, but you know, you only get from 0 to 80% whenever you plug in, you're only getting about 2.5 miles of range added for every minute of charging. So it's a very slow go, which is, you know, ultimately you want to know how long it takes you to add back range, you know, about 40 minutes to get 100 miles of range, and you're only adding 2.5 miles of range for every minute. After 80%, from 80% to 100%, you add 1 mile of range per minute. So it really slows down after 80%.
Yeah, man.
Well, those arrows were perfectly timed to what you were talking about. That was pretty incredible.
Yeah. Oh, no, that was a little late. That was the
All right.
We don't just throw this show together, you know? Yeah. There's actually some planning behind it.
Everything is scripted. Don't worry.
So speaking of shows, that brings us to the end of this one. We're a little over our time. So if you have any questions or comments, you can leave them on the Inside EVs forum podcast thread, or on our YouTube or Twitch comment sections. If you like the show, give us a thumbs up if you're watching us on YouTube, and subscribe please. Don't forget, you can find and follow our panelists on Twitter. Follow Tom Malogny at Tomalog. That's with two M's. Martin Lee is at EV News Daily. Kyle Connor is at It's Kyle Connor. And I'm at Dominic_Y. Dominic_Y. Yes. So click subscribe, tap that bell icon for notifications, and we'll see you all again next week. Ciao.